Okay.
Yep. Ready to go, Frank.
Go ahead, man.
And welcome, everyone, to a very special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course, I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, buddy?
Not much, man. Super excited again.
Yep, we've had lots to be excited about. Tonight is no exception. We're joined by cinematographer Alvin Kuchler. And he is the cinematographer on the new film Steve Jobs, which is from director Danny Boyle and is set for release later this fall in October. It's going to go limited release and then wide. And it's just started to make the festival rounds, and it's riding a huge wave of buzz right now. Very positive responses coming out of the various film festivals. Frank and I are really excited to see it. Alvin has previously worked with Danny Boyle on the movie Sunshine, which is a really cool science fiction movie that everybody should check out if you're unaware of it. And he also notably worked with Joe Wright on the film Hannah, as well as on the movie Solitary Man, which Frank and I are big fans of, with Michael Douglas. He's had some blockbuster work shooting Divergent. He's also had some notable collaborations with the director Lynn Ramsey, both Morvern Collar and Ratcatcher. And he's also done a couple movies for both Michael Winterbottom and Kevin MacDonald. And he's been one of those cinematographers that's worked in a variety of genres over the last, let's say, 15 years. And he's always taking on interesting and thoughtful material. Results are always stylish in a very unique way. So it's a pleasure to get him on the show today and talk about his career and talk about Steve Jobs. Welcome to the show, Alvin.
Thank you. Good evening. Hi, Frank. Hi, Nick. It's good that your names are up here, so I can I'm really bad with names.
Perfect. Yeah. Works out well. Yeah, man, thank you so much for coming on the show. I told you prior, Nick and I are just looking so forward to seeing Steve Jobs. I remember when it broke, all the talent that was involved with it, and when the first trailer hit, I was just completely blown away, and I can't even wait to see it. It looks gorgeous.
I mean, the trailer is even, there are even some scenes which are by now cut out, but that project, I'm very glad that project came along. It came along, you know, out of the blue, because everybody knows the story that, you know, the film was originally with Sony and, you know, David Fincher was attached to it, and eventually was attached with with Danny Boyle, and then I think Michael Fassbender, the actor, became available, and then suddenly Danny Boyle was on the plane to L.A., and I suddenly got a call from out of the blue from the producer, Bernie Bellew, the line producer, who I haven't spoken to maybe for 4 or 5 years. Well, actually, no, that's not true, like 3 years. And then he said, oh, can you come in, and would you be able to shoot, start prepping this movie in a week's time? So it was so obviously, you know, having worked with Danny before, you know, it's not a hard sell for me to work with Danny again. So, you know, I would have agreed to it without reading the script, but they tended to me, and you know, like it took me by surprise, because obviously, of course, I knew Aaron Sorkin, and I knew Aaron Sorkin work from Social Network, but you know, I couldn't put the. I started reading the script, and I couldn't put it down. It was like a thriller with words. It was fantastic, and it was it was joy to read. And you know, I'm a dyslexic German, and I'm not that keen normally on reading scripts. So it was. But I was really pulled into it. I was really pulled into it, and I was pulled into it that it was funny, and it was, you know, smart, and was informative, and you know, the characters were all, you know, fascinating. So it was a great opportunity, and I knew that, you know, straight away. And it's a joy to work with Danny. I think he's like, he should give workshops for other directors on how to work with crews, because he's got incredible skills to, you know, motivate his crews and make it a joy, you know, to turn up on the set and be excited to work for him and with them. So it was fun. It also was very much fun because, you know, as you mentioned, like the previous projects were, you know, Divergent, and then I did like a bit of a stinker called RAPD. But in terms of box office. But so it was fun to work with on a film set where, you know, the director is a filmmaker and it's a filmmaking project. And, you know, of course, when you work with somebody like Danny Boyle and it's like the budget size and the combination of that budget size and Danny Boyle, you know, they leave him alone. You know, he's like the man in control and it's really, truly his vision. And you're trying to work with him on creating a great vision, you know. So, yes, it's an absolute pleasure. I mean, I you know, it's also like I knew straight away when you hear, you know, I was always thought Michael Fassbender is a fantastic actor. You know, he has got an edge, and Kate Winslet. I always was a big fan of Kate Winslet, and but also the other parts were fantastic. You know, Seth Rogen and the guy, and you know, Scully. You know, the actor. Help me out here.
Jeff Daniels,
and the actor who played Andy Hertzfeld. They were all like, it was just a fantastic, it was just a fantastic group of actors. But you know, the very first thing Danny said to me is, you know, he said to me, well, Jobs is like a theater piece. It's like a 3-act theater piece. And what I want to do is I want to, you know, rehearse the first act, you know, shoot the first act, and then shut down production, and then rehearse the second act and shoot it, and then do the same for the third act. And because he said, look, it's not I want to shoot it at all like, you know, this the other film called, you know, the one Shibu won an Oscar for, Birdman. Yeah, he doesn't, you know, because it's actually in similar spaces, you know, it's like in theatrical spaces, and it's kind of, the spaces were similar, and also because, you know, the word count is so big, so he said, oh, I don't want to do it as like Birdman, so it's not like I'm going to try to do it all in one take, but I still want to cover long takes, because, and I want the actors to be really on top of the energy, so that as soon as they come, you know, on set, it's like they're like racehorses out of the opening gate, and they're just ready to fire, and that's kind of what happened. But the other thing, which is I think is interesting to mention about Danny Boyle, or working with Danny Boyle, is because it was similar. Even though Sunshine was a completely different movie than Steve Jobs, but what is interesting about it is like Danny Boyle is always creating some of the atmosphere, what happens in front of the screen, also behind the screen. And in the case of Steve Jobs, it's like, this, you know, the story is very much about, you know, keeping up with Steve Jobs. You know, like, you know, Steve Jobs is, in the script, is constantly on the move. And there's some very few scenes, and it's very much consciously, you know, when he doesn't walk or run. So it was constantly, he's on the walk, and people trying to keep up with Steve Jobs. And he's kind of a bit like, you know, the sun, and you've got all these other planets kind of circulating around the sun. And it's kind of this you know, this man who has got this gravity of all these people whirling around him. And yeah, I lost my thread now. So that was one of the things which was very important to Danny. And the other thing which was very important, he said to me, you know, we have to find a really good Steadicam operator, because it's all, you know, it will all come down to Steadicam operator. And it was kind of good because it was interesting because, you know, a lot of films are very Steadicam heavy, but he was like, you know, serious about, there are some scenes we shot where we had to walk over 3 floors to the San Francisco Opera, and we shot with you know, a 35mm camera. So you're talking about so you needed somebody who had the athletic capability of doing it, and then you needed somebody ideally also who had the intellectual capability of it, which would give him the motivation to even last 3 floors, and then probably do another 4 takes. So it was a, it was a specific task, you know, to seek out, you know, a fantastic Steadicam operator. We ended up with, you know, Jeff Healy, who was truly formidable. And so, yeah, and of course, the other big thing to mention, you know, about Steve Jobs was that you because the three acts, they have got a very similar structure. I mean, every act is about, you know, the 30 minutes before a launch, you know, like the stressful run up to a launch, and it's about, you know, him meeting all these meet people and bumping into these people and having these conversations with these people. So one of my early suggestions was kind of with Danny was kind of to say, well, you know, it kind of offers itself to go from 35 to digital, and then subsequently to go. So first act was 16 mil, second act was 35, and the last act was digital.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was obviously, you know, that's a kind of fun for a cinematographer, of course, as well. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, you can look at the Steve Jobs as a man who certainly is one of the main people why we are so used to the aesthetic of digital now. So it was like a fantastic kind of storyline which kind of offered itself up. And then, you know, Danny, he thought it was a great idea because he felt it was reflecting, because I think he felt like it would help to, you know, refresh the three acts, you know, or the similarity of the structure of the three acts. So he felt like, well, if they're very similar, they could be aesthetically very different, you know. But I mean, the funny thing is, like, you know, when I did the first test for 60 mil, and it comes up, we both went like, oh my god, it's like we forgot the grain. You know, it's like the grain is, we are not used to any grain anymore. And suddenly, if you see 60 mil, it really hit us in the face. But the interesting thing is, like, once you look at it for 2-3 minutes, you just get into the story and you forget about it. And I think even Danny mentioned, you know, like I said, you know, I said to Danny, after the first test screenings, I said, like, so, Danny, I have to know what the people were saying about the 60 mil and stuff. And they said, you know what? I asked them, I asked them the question. A lot of people say, what are you talking about? You know? So it's like, as a cinematographer, it's like, you kind of ask yourself, well, Jesus, if they don't see 60 mil, what needs to happen? You know, like, but the funny thing is, like, when you talk about these things, you don't know how much they subconsciously notice things and then how much they can consciously kind of figure it out. You know? So that's the interesting aspect about it.
Yeah, and one of the things that, you know, Frank and I, you know, we're both big fans of Danny Boyle, and he's one of those filmmakers that is pure cinema. You know, all of his films have an interesting pulse, and they have a very unique forward momentum to them. And he's somebody that's attracted to making his stories feel cinematic. And that's one of the things I had read about. So I haven't, you know, Frank and I haven't seen Steve Jobs yet. But that's one of the things I'd read about and was very anxious to hear about was the division of, you know, the style between the 16 millimeter, the 35 and the digital. If given a preference for you personally, are you still somebody that would be wishing to shoot 35 millimeter all day? Or are you a digital cinematographer fan, or how do the styles work for you these days?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I still love 35 mil, you know, full stop. I mean, I still prefer this. Most of the time, I prefer film. And I just think there's just a quality. To me, it's more soulful. You know, there's something, you know, I always find that, you know, like when the cinematographers, I could feel like, you know, every cinematographer had such a, their own way of exposing film stock. I mean, even if you give the same cinematographer the same lens and the same camera and the same film stock, but the way you expose it and the way you consistently, you know, use it, I think there's a certain craft to it, or a master craft to it, that, you know, you convey. I always feel like I could convey more, I could put more feeling into it, you know. But maybe that's also because I still have to get better digital, you know. But the thing is, like, I mean, at nighttime I do like digital because I like, you know, I like that. The thing which I enjoy about digital sometimes is that you kind of can use such small light sources as light sources, and they count. That, you know, at nighttime, I kind of like it, and I think I like it. Sometimes I like it when it enables you to be more spontaneous, or you kind of, you know, if you want to suddenly shoot out on the street and you just need, you know, a sun gun or whatever, you know, that can also be an advantage. And but the other interesting thing is, like, you know, I just recently used for the first time, you know, I used the Alexa Mini, and I just the focus puller, he rigged it really well for me, and I just loved, you know, holding it. It was like the first time where I thought, well, you know, it's like, if the cameras are lighter than film cameras, or you can physically, so like imagine like the Red or the Alexa Mini, you kind of can hold in your two hands, and you can yourself go from feet high to, you know, stretch your arms above your head in one shot. So if you can do that, then you can do something with a digital camera you can't necessarily do with a film camera. Also, you know, when you shoot inside cars, the cameras can be smaller, and therefore you can get them at angles you couldn't with a film camera. So if they, you know, so because also because I, you know, very originally I come from stills photography, and I still very much enjoy stills photography. I do like the feeling that you can walk around it with it like a stills camera, and you suddenly take a picture or you film it. You know what I mean? So I like that, but in the overall feeling, you know, like I still, it's kind of interesting when you look at the 60mm camera, because you suddenly realize the grain is so big. And if you have like a wide shot, and there's like, you know, the people are, you've got two people talking and they're fairly small in the frame, on digital, you can still see their facial expressions perfectly fine. On 16mm, you suddenly realize the resolution is actually so little that you are starting to struggle to see the exact features of the actors. But, you know, sometimes it's like, I think it's whatever the feeling it is you want to convey, to me it's still a beautiful tool. And even like these, you know, some of the lenses that the focus would fall to pieces on the edges and everything in 60mm. But personally, I think it's extremely beautiful and painterly, you know. And especially for this movie, I'm really glad that I could do it that way, because, you know, the spaces we were in, they were, you know, you've got the big auditorium, and then you've got the backstage rooms, which are not necessarily a cinematographer's, you know, dream. You know, it's not like there's nothing, there's, it's hard to, you can't really show off with them, or there's not like the, you're in corridors and you're in spaces where they are traditionally lit with fluorescent lights, or now more with LED lights. So you can't like completely falsify what these spaces, you know, would look like, you know. So so it was a great opportunity just to play with these three formats. And it's kind of interesting also, you know, because a 60mm camera is so light that it does influence the operating as well. You know, I spoke to Jeff about it, like about the operating, you know, because it's like, if you're on a Steadicam is designed that you keep a certain amount of mass steady. If that mass becomes too light, then it's like at some point you're going to have to add weight to it, because otherwise the Steadicam doesn't work anymore, you know. So it was technically interesting. And, you know, we try to keep as much reality in it. For example, like in the first act, I tried to light as much as I could with light sources from the time, you know. Like I really tried to ban LED as much as I could, because you know, I feel the LED lights, they also give it a certain aesthetic, you know. So I tried to do it as much with fluorescent lights and, you know, tungsten bulbs from that period as I could. And then of course, like with the production designer, you know, he created a great palette of, you know, these 70s, 80s greens and oranges, you know, which made these spaces much more, you know, brought these spaces alive. And he used, you know, the lines in a dramatic trajectory, and you know, it was very much fun also to work with the production designer. So that's, now you have to give me another question.
No, that's fantastic. I can't believe you used three different formats to shoot this film. This gets me so much more excited to see it. I can't even wait to see this now. And I love knowing this going into it now. It makes it that much more special.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you, one of my favorite films that I've seen in probably the past, five, six years old now, but it blew me away the first time I saw it was Solitary Man.
Oh.
And that became like an instant classic for me, and I think that's one of Michael Douglas's best performances ever, if not his best. But I just remember seeing that for the first time, and I probably watched it five or six times during like the first 2 weeks of originally seeing it. I went out and I bought the Blu-ray instantly. Yeah. I remember I rented it, and then I went out and I bought the Blu-ray, and I was just obsessed with
it. So what do you think spoke to you like that? What do you connect? What do you connect with, or what do you?
It was, you know, essentially what grabbed me instantly, and I knew I was going to love this film, was the opening credits of him walking around the city to Johnny Cash's Solitary Man. He's all dressed in black. He's obviously transformed from the opening scene where we see him, and he's got his lighter hair, and he's dressed more conservative but colorful, and then the life change happens, and he snaps back, and, you know, he's invented himself, but then he reinvents himself.
Right, yeah.
And that's what I absolutely loved about that. I mean, that's one of my favorite Charles Bukowski lines, too, but that was excellent. And you know what? I think what also sealed was I loved it. I loved the friendship between he and Danny DeVito and how they hadn't seen each other in, like, 30 years, and then they reconnect, and it's like they don't skip a beat, and it's like they've seen each other every day for
you know that they were really flatmates, right, as students. So they actually did really know it themselves. I think Michael Douglas talked him into taking the part, you know? But that was It was actually an enjoyable film to do. It was like, you know, it was a small film. I mean, you know, it was 10 million. And it was, you know, it was fun to work with, you know, Brian Koppelman and David Levine. They're more writers than they have done now two. I think they have directed two or three films. I think it was number three or something. So it was interesting because they weren't that experienced. I felt like, you know, for once I had to be really responsible to kind of help them tell the story rather than, you know, to get, you know, get off on one on some fancy shots or something. So you know, when you're in New York shooting for 10 million, and you kind of know they can't afford to go an hour over 10 hours and stuff like that, there's a lot of pressure on, you know, shooting it, but also shooting it, you know, on time. So, I loved the energy of New York, and I loved, you know, I loved scouting New York, and I still love, you know, like, because we had to find, you know, for the character in Solitary Man, for the wife, you know, that apartment where he goes to. We looked at so many 30 properties, which they were all on the market for $30 million. You know what I mean? And obviously, like a film like that, you know, can't afford, you know, the people who own these apartments or houses, they're not interested in the money. I mean, they don't need the little money we can afford, or what is little to them. They're not interested. So you had to kind of get them, like, you know, do you want to spend 4 days with Michael Douglas in your afternoon, in your living room, you know? So that, I think that was what it was, you know, what was great, what made it work in the end. But I saw some of these fantastic houses, you know, and you suddenly go around and think, oh my God, there's a league of people out there, you know, there's like living in a different galaxy, you know. it's like living in New York with all the hustle and bustle, and then you kind of escape in your mansion or in your castle, you know.
So yeah, there's a casual elegance to Solitary Man, and you know, one of the things that I responded so much to it is that it feels like one of those career defining roles for an actor where they've sort of been leading up to that performance, or that particular role has been written. I don't know if Kopelman and Levine wrote the part specifically for Michael Douglas, but it just seemed like one of those roles that, you know, was tailor made for somebody and only he could have done. And I think the feeling of like loneliness that movie sort of discusses, you know, he's like this aged, you know, womanizer, and, you know, the emotional through line of that film is what got to me, the most certainly. And again, just sort of aided by this really nice, unassuming, not show-off-y style, that you brought to the film.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't have the time to show off. No, but I mean, I mean, it was clear that, you know, it was clear what we wanted to hit. And, but it was also, you know, the other thing which was fun about it is, you know, because Michael Douglas is, you know, for God's sake, he produced One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you know what I mean? So he's a filmmaker, he's very much a filmmaker himself, you know, so he does understand, he does understand the actual process. So, and that really was sometimes crucial, you know, like if he would go in and you had an afternoon to shoot the scene in, you know, where he goes, you know, visiting his daughter and his, you know, the son of his daughter in the apartment, you know, you've got an afternoon. He was the one who, you know, that would rehearse the scene, and then he would be really aware. It's like, if I'm facing this way, then you have to shoot a reverse. If I play it, you know, I walk around this way, you know, you end up with my face again, and you save the reverse. You know, so he really helped the process, you know, immensely, in the sense of making it, you know, being a really good actor in it, as well as helping it technically, you know, about you know, how we can simplify it. I mean, so that was a great experience. I mean, like, if you just come from Europe, and then you know, with legends like Michael Douglas, or even with Harrison Ford, I had this experience, you know, where you think, wow, they're legends and they're really good and they're technically really good. So Michael Douglas was great, helping us out that way. I remember there was one time where I was working with Harrison Ford on a film called Morning Glory. I don't know if you've seen
I've seen it.
Yeah, I very much enjoyed it.
And you know, like, you know, the streets in New York is like, you know, you've got these massive sun and shadows, and it's like the exposure is more than in other cities, because the houses are so close together. So if you go from shadow into sun, you burn out, you know what I mean, if you are not prepared for it. And we did this really long Steadicam shot with him, where he was talking with Rachel McAdams. It was like, you know, whatever, however long the magazine was, like a 4-minute Steadicam shot. On the last take, you know, his the sun came around by 1 foot and was right on his mark, and he played the whole scene, you know, normally, and that's just before. He just ended just before he hit the sun, and you kind of think, wow, you know, that guy is so focused that he still hits that, you know, he just adjusted it and made the take work. So that was quite impressive, you know. So, yeah, sometimes in Europe, there's more this tradition about, you know, like, actors don't want to think about it. Actors, you know, they want their freedom, you know, and stuff like that. So it was kind of interesting to see, you know, when you work with that generation, which are, you know, also technically really good, you know what I mean?
Well, definitely want to add to talk to you about one of the more really stylish films of the last few years, which would be Hannah. And it's a movie that is sort of like, it bends genre here and there. It's not exactly a spy movie, but it's not exactly an action film, and it's kind of this. And I wanted to ask about one particular sequence because I've always been pretty much in awe of it. That fight in the subway with Eric Bana, where he is taking on like four or five different guys, and it appears to be one long Steadicam take of him,
yeah,
you know, walking and being followed and then sizing everybody up and going after. Can you tell me, you know, how that was conceived and where the idea to shoot that fight came from?
Well, I mean, I think you know, Joe Wright, he also likes his long continuous shot. I mean, he did that in, you know, in Atonement. So, but also I think he felt, you know, the challenge of one approach, you know, fight scenes differently. And I think I thought that was a really interesting thought, you know, because, you know, fight scenes are so much, you know, done through cuts, you know, and the cuts make it look faster and the impact look faster. So if you get a stunt coordinator this brief, I think that is the hardest brief for any stunt coordinator, because you have to kind of work out in a continuous move where's the camera relation to, you know, a punch, you know. So I think it was partly from, you know, Joe Wright wanting to push the element of you know, how to approach fight sequence differently. But also I think it works very well because, you know, the tension you convey through not cutting away from it, you kind of sticking with the actor, I thought it really increased, you know, his paranoia about being or being attacked, you know. And then technically it was, of course, it was really, you know, tricky because he comes from out of the bus with roofs, momentarily walks into the sun, goes into a building made out of glass, comes out of the building into the full sun, goes down some staircases where it gets darker, and then ends up in a fluorescent lit, you know, environment. And so, you know, that's one kind of thing where, okay, on this one of the moments where if I would have to do it again, and I would, that's probably one of the scenes where I say, well, you know, maybe you should do that on digital, because you end up knowing what you got on film.
So that was, the whole sequence was shot on film. That was not shot digitally.
No, that was prior. I don't think even the Alexa was out, you know.
Oh my! It's even more amazing. Always wondered if there was like CGI assisted moves, or if it was just a Steadicam operator doing this amazing dance around everybody.
No. So the whole move was executed by a Steadicam operator, but you know, I was running around almost like on the reset. I was running around, you know, taking my light readings, and then we had this, you know, this drill about then the clapper loader had to run along with them and pull the iris. Do you know what I mean? So literally the iris went up from, you know, full sun probably from 20. I think the whole stop varied from a stop of 22 to fully open Cook lens f2. You know, and you probably, if you would review it, if when he goes out and there are these posters, you can probably see there's a lot of depth of field, and then when he's underneath the where they're fighting, you know, the iris is fully open. And the only thing they did that was also really interesting, because I haven't seen that done before, was so they did this fight in one shot for real, and the only thing they did is like because obviously it can't be as precise, because it's not like you do one fist approaching the chin in one take and then another take, and the camera's right in the right ideal spot. So they digitally sometimes, you know, decrease the distance between the fist and the chin or whatever to make the to make the impact more vicious. So that was a really interesting. I've never seen that before, that was really interesting. I thought about it, you know.
How long did it take to shoot that, and how many different times did you try?
You know, to be honest, I think because it's like still like 5 minutes screen time or 4 minutes screen time, I think it took us the whole day. So you would rehearse it, you know, then you would kind of, you'd rehearse it without the Steadicam, you just rehearse it, and we would walk around with the viewfinder, and then, you know, eventually, you know, the Steadicam guy would then do a rehearsal with the Steadicam. But there are like two scenes we did like that way, and I did like that about Joe Wright. There's another scene in Hannah which is a flashback where we see, you know, it's basically where the car burns and he runs into the forest. And it's also unlike the shot we just talking about, that was on Steadicam, that was a shot which was a mixture out of handheld and, you know, we built a specific rig so that the guy could stand in handheld and then probably run out of it and stuff like that. But because it was all meant to be a dusk, you know. So a lot of times directors would say, oh, you know, we've got this dust scene, you know, like, I don't know how to do it, and maybe it can't be a dust scene. And so it's kind of cool when a director says, you know what, we just rehearse that scene all day, and then we shoot it in a 3 minute window. Because it's obviously it's like nerve wracking, because if you don't get it, you fucked, you know, basically. But, yeah. So it's a bit like tight ropes without a net. But, you know what else happens? What is pretty cool when you do a shot like this? It's actually it's like a great bonding exercise for the crew, because everybody in the crew knows, you know, I don't want to be the one who fucked up the whole day's work, you know. So everybody has to be so absolutely focused in this 5 minutes of dusk. I mean, I think the dusk shot, we could do three takes, and then we did a fourth take, but that was then unusable. But you walk away from it, it's like a football team who won the World Cup, and you give each other a high five, because you kind of work under this pressure cooker and you pulled it off. So it's like, and every, there's a lot of people involved in it having to pull it off. There's like the focus puller who has to get it right. There's, you know, the loader who had to get the iris right. You know, there's the Steadicam operator who has got the operating right. There's the boom guys who tries not to get into the shot. You know, there's so many people who things you don't see on the camera, which, you know, which creating this choreography. So it's an exciting, approach. I mean, and I think, you know, filmmaking, I think it's always, filmmaking is great with filmmakers who invite the risk and together around a bunch of people where you support each other in taking risks. You know what I mean? Because I think, you know, it's like, I don't think it's very good. It's like, you don't want to be in an environment where anybody says absolutely, you know, oh, I told you so, that wouldn't work. Or, you know, like, I think it's, you know, I think it's, filmmaking can only be as long as exciting as we, the filmmakers, are excited about it. And that is about, you know, you have to, every time you do it, you have to push yourself, you know, because you have to find, you know, something which, ideally, you know, it's always good to feel a bit scared, you know, when you do something. Because when you're scared, you know, that means you are really alive and you're really concentrating and you're excited about what you're doing, you know. So, I mean, there's also a curse in the filmmaking, because, you know, it's a curse because, you know, how many more times can you climb a mountain peak, you know? So it's like this, I think it's a blessing and a curse at the same time, that every time you do something, you kind of trying to push yourself. You know? It's kind of,
yeah.
It's kind of funny, you know, with you know, with digital and film, you know, because also like with film, there's so many, you know, like a pilot who goes through all the checks. Like, yeah, there's so many checks we do every time, you know, which you don't even think about. You know what I mean? It's like driving a car. Whatever. You just do the certain things you do when you are not even aware of it. And if you don't shoot film for a year and then suddenly you kind of shoot film again, it's like you do feel a bit like a rusty piano player. You know what I mean? Where you kind of, oh, how did I do that again? I mean, it comes back really quickly, but it's it is a great craft, you know, which unfortunately, you know, is also affected by the labs and, you know, the whole, there's so many great craft people in the labs, you know what I mean, which, and nobody, there's no new people being trained up, you know, so that's the scary part, you know. The labs are changing, they had to change, they had to streamline, and they're not, I don't think that hardly any new training happens, you know what I mean, to follow. So it's going to be interesting, you know, to see. Can you, in 5 years' time or 10 years' time, you know, it's like maybe there's like a little boutique lab, you know, where you can give your film on it, but it might be, by that time it might be so expensive that, you know, people say, oh, you know, we just use that plugin which gives it to the film grain, you know, or, so it's going to be interesting what happens to film in 5-10 years' time.
Certainly. One thing I want to ask you before we sign off with you is, you know, looking over your credits, you have an amazing list of credits. It's incredible. And, you know, I think probably the film that has affected me the most that you've shot would be Ratcatcher.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw that when I was in college, and I was completely – that movie knocked me on my ass, man.
Oh, cool.
I mean, it's just – it's so intense without, you know, the intent – it's a hard film to describe because the realism of it.
Yeah.
And how gritty and dilapidated it looks. I mean, I just remember seeing it. And I have a Criterion DVD. I mean, I just remember seeing it for the first time, and I was like, oh, my God. But I mean, I love it. It's truly remarkable.
Yeah, that's
and,
yeah.
No, go ahead.
No, I mean, it's an interesting one because, you know, like it's a film which, you know, we as filmmakers, we were, of course, our first film, we were so raw that, you know, for years I couldn't enjoy the film because, you know, we were working with, you know, they do something called in England, they do this thing, they have a completion bond insurance, which kind of means that they sign an insurance which guarantees somehow that this film will be completed. And
oh, wow.
And this completion bond, they hate, they know, okay, we need new directors, but they don't like new designers and DPs and stuff like that because it could be a potential, you know, they think, oh, you know, there's always a theory about, oh, we use this fresh director and surround him with lots of talent, and that's going to make it safe. Which is kind of, at the time, was kind of ironic to me because you kind of think, well, okay, now you've got a fresh director, but he's not allowed to do what he wants to do because you give him experienced crew, then tell the director how he should do it, you know what I mean, or she. But anyway, we were all friends, and to keep the cost down, we shared apartments. We didn't have no discipline. You know, we would tell each other, everybody would tell each other their problems. And, you know, there was the AD who was kind of forced upon us from that insurance. We didn't get on with him, and he just reported negatively about us. and, you know, after 2 weeks, I think they threatened to fire the producer, and then they threatened to fire me, and if he wouldn't speed up, and then they would fire the director if he still wouldn't be fast. I don't know. So, and then the director and the producer had big arguments behind the scenes. So there was a lot of drama. So by the end of the film, I you know, like it's kind of ironic because at the end of the film, I thought, wow, great, you know, I survived my first completion bonded movie, because it's a bit like a chicken and egg situation. You have to do a movie like that, you know, to get other movies, but nobody wants you to do that first movie because nobody trusts you. So it's very tricky, you know, and that when you start off like that. And Lynn Ramsey is fantastic because even at their short films, you know, she had like a short film which was funded by the Scottish, where she is from, the Scottish country. And they said, well, yeah, but, you know, the Scottish Film Fund, you know, you're supposed to use Scottish HODs. And she just would say, no, no, listen, this is my crew. Take it or leave it. You know, so she was like always like that. She was always like, no, no. She wouldn't even negotiate about that. She would just say, no, no, this is the people I work with. Otherwise I'm not doing the movie. And she wouldn't even allow that to open. And that, you know, that 5 foot little Scottish woman has got a strong will. So that was great. So that was our first opportunity. But, you know, like at the time I walked away from it and thought, wow, man, if all movies are that stressful, I might reconsider my career. You know? It's like that was kind of like, you know, to hell and back. But, you know, it's kind of funny. And then, you know, like, so I didn't think any more of it. And then it came out and then it became really, it was like, for me, it was a game changer because, you know, I wasn't naturally very good at selling myself. I hated all the selling stuff. Somehow it hit a nerve, and I think it expressed maybe how a generation was feeling or whatever. And it suddenly established us as whatever, the new young talents. And suddenly I would get interviews and people wanted to work with me, you know, in music videos and commercials. And then I did a TV series, and then I did my first film with Michael Winterbottom. So it really changed everything, you know, like from having long walks in the park thinking, oh, will I ever have a career, to, you know, doing a movie which suddenly changed everything for me. So that was really interesting. And it's an interesting experience because, I mean, I think it's an interesting experience for, you know, younger people. Because it's kind of funny. It's like I had conversations like that with some younger filmmakers. You know, they hang in there, and, you know, it can take 3-4 years, and then eventually you doubt yourself. You know, is that the right thing to do or whatever? And then you don't know. And then I think you need to be really talented. I think you need to be really persistent. And I think you need to be so hungry for it that you can't imagine anything else to do. But also you need to have luck to get the right break, you know. You need to have the luck to have the right break, you know.
And you know, luck and talent play a big part. And when you look at your credits, you know, you've worked with a number of filmmakers twice. You know, you look at the credits, you have Kevin MacDonald a couple of times, Roger Michelle a couple of times, Lynn Ramsey, Danny Boyle, Michael Winterbottom. So it becomes one of those things where you're led to believe that, you know, filmmakers trust your vision and trust your skills, and they understand where you're coming from as an artist. And I wanted to throw a quick mention, because I know we're getting close to the end of our chat. The Claim by Michael Winterbottom, I'm just such a huge fan of that movie. It's so underrated. I love telling people about it, and I'll probably do a write-up soon on that online. It's one of those movies that I just feel that, you know, if only more people could have seen it. I don't even think there's a Blu-ray release out there or anything. That must have been a really fun project to get a chance to shoot a period Western like that when people aren't getting a chance to make too many of those movies. Especially, you know, that was, I'm trying to remember what year exactly that was, probably the early 2000s, 2000, 2001. So that was even before Westerns were mildly back in vogue the way that they are now. But yeah, it's just incredible to take, like Frank said.
I'm really glad you mentioned that film because, I mean, if any of the films, like, you know, to be honest, I'm still really proud of that film. And I think, you know, I was so excited to get this film and to work with Michael Winterbottom on it. You know what I mean? It's like, I just did the film for Ratcatcher for whatever, £3 million, and then suddenly, you know, there was a movie for £20 million, and then, you know, then there was Nastassja Kinski in it, and Nastassja Kinski, I had a crush on as a teenager when she was in a Tatort crimi series, and she had the most beautiful breasts and stuff like that. And so it was, I thought, like, oh my God, like 20 million, it's like a Hollywood movie, and I get to work with Nastassja Kinski. So that was, I was really, really excited. I met the fantastic production designer, Mark Tilsley, on it, with who I worked with on Sunshine. And it was fantastic. And I never forget, like, the first time, you know, that took me to set, they already had, because the production is that I had to race to build a town before the earth would freeze. So they were racing against the season. So the first time I came there, they were still building it. But I arrived on one side of the mountain, and there were these huge snow buses with, they have got in Canada, they've got these snow buses. They've got, like, these ropes, you know, what do you call them? Like, what tanks have, you know, these,
treads?
Treads or whatever, yeah. And they go, like, they take whole buses like that over the hill. And then it was already late, so they had everywhere these halogen lights, which were extremely bright in the snow. And it reminded me of the scene of Kubrick's 2001, when they find the monolith, you know, there's this eerie atmosphere. And then we would go up that mountain, and then on top of that, and suddenly it was like a time travel. You would go, you know, with something which looked like a science fiction film, you go up the mountain, and then suddenly the vehicle tips over the peak, and you look down there, and there was, you know, cowboys with cows on horses and stuff like that, and it was suddenly transformed into that century. So it was so exciting to, you know, to work on it and have that opportunity.
It's such a unique film, because it's an American set Western made by a British filmmaker with European talent up the wazoo, and it predates, you know, obviously, you know, There Will Be Blood was based on a book, but, you know, when you look back on it, there's elements of There Will Be Blood, and there's elements of, you know, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and I just feel like it's one of those movies that just, it didn't get the acclaim it deserved. It, you know, it was well reviewed by most critics, but it's one of those movies that just doesn't find the audience it truly deserves when it's initially released.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, it's also one of the films where I'm, you know, I still think, yeah, where I feel the same way. I feel like the film is so much better than it is known. I mean, the other interesting thing, cinematography-wise, at this film was that we used a Tarkovsky technique where you mix, you know, we shot it on color, and then they made an inter negative on black and white, and then in optically you combine the two together, and you can choose the percentage of the color neg and the black and white neg. So you kind of it was the old school of decreasing colors.
So that's why it has that old school vintage look.
Yeah, I think that. I mean, you know, like, to be honest, I would. I think the next time I go to London, I might actually contact Andrew Eaton, the producer, because I would love to see a print again, because
I don't think there's a Blu-ray out there unless there's been one released overseas. I got to check online after our chat, because it's such an awesome movie.
Yeah, there should be a movement. Make a Blu-ray of The Claim.
I'll start the petition.
Maybe you should start the petition. Because honestly, I think it's a really good film. I think a lot of people accused it of being emotionally quite cold. But I think, you know, there was an English actor who once said, like, you know, like, most period films say more about the times we live in than about the times that were made about. And I think, you know, Michael Winterbottom always also has got this approach. He wants to do it as much as he can as a documentary, or at least at the time he had. And I think, of course, you know, people who lived in these days, when somebody died, they don't have the time to kind of make it a big mournful scene. You know, I think they were tougher because they had to be tougher. You know, and I think that was kind of, I think this, it was kind of conveyed. You know, there was on this mountain we were filming. There was one area because of the, there was always a draft. You know, between the mountains. There was always a wind coming from a certain direction causing a draft. So there was always a snowstorm. And you could literally schedule, you know, today at 4 o'clock we go to the snowstorm, you know, so which was, you know, great. But it was also physically, it was really tough, you know what I mean? Like, we were like, every day we were like up to our knees in snow. There was, every day there would be new snow falling.
The ruggedness of the product. Honestly, if that movie came out in the 70s, people would have immediately called it a masterpiece. It would have been received in such a different way because you're right. It has a coldness to it, but an appropriate coldness because, like you said, that's the way that people probably would have behaved back in that time. And, you know, the aughts, 2000, you know, to 2000, you know, that the whole early 2000s was an interesting time for cinema in general. There was a big transition between, you know, people not wanting to really see anti-heroes and flawed, you know, flawed characters as your leads. And that movie is, you know, varying shades of moral ambiguity and everything else. And it's just, it's a great film. Alvin, thank you. I know we got to be mindful of the time with you. I mean, we could chat with you all night, but, you know, we really appreciate you coming on the show and chatting us up on Steve Jobs. Is there anything else you want to throw us at the end here?
Oh, no, I just wanted to add, I also thought, like, you know, I think Peter Mullen was a great actor, or is a great actor, you know? Like,
oh, yeah. He's,
you know, he was physically tough, you know, like the scene he had to lie in the snow to die, and you know, we kept shooting. And it's, seriously, he was like minus 20, minus 30 Celsius, you know, and I think he did walk away with a pneumonia from it. But, it was a great adventure. I wish people, more people would see it. But yes, let's stick to the start a petition about people should see make a Blu-ray of The Claim.
Certainly. Certainly.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming on, man. This has been incredible.
Oh yeah, it was fun. It was.
Sounds good. I'm sure we'll contact you somewhere down the road.
Yeah, we'll.
Do you want to come on and talk about one of your new projects or something like that?
Okay.
Door's always open.
Oh, well, thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Fun. Thank you.
Major pleasure. Bye. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Frank.
Yep.